A three-time Georgia Author of the Year in poetry, Stephen Corey is a literary juggler. The editor of the National Magazine Award-winning The Georgia Review, he has also edited several anthologies of fiction, poetry, and essays, and a new series of Georgia Review books, a collaboration with the University of Georgia Press. But it's his own recent book, Startled at the Big Sound, Essays Personal, Literary, and Cultural from Mercer University Press, that gives insight into his life as he examines language as a writer, reader, editor, reviewer, and family man.
And so I have been working extra hard of late to shun the false idol of wisdom and to embrace the bugaboo of perplexity.
Listen to Stephen Corey read from his essays and poetry today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and we talked at WUGA in Athens in August 2017, the year Startled at the Big Sound was released. He was also in the midst of a year-long celebration of the 70th anniversary of the Georgia Review, where he's worked his way through the ranks for nearly half those years. We'll hear more about that in a bit. But first, let's listen to a poem from his earlier book, There Is No Finished World. Here's Stephen Corey.
My daughter playing Beethoven on my chest for Rebecca. She was 9, on the absolute edge between her dying childhood and that confusing ecstasy to come, then go in another decade's rush. We were simply chattering. I seated and she standing before me, she spinning those silly child's nonsense tales, still lingering, circular repeating jabberings a part of me laughs and loves to hear, though often I am quickly bored, annoyed, wishing to escape the wishing her fantasy of words and voices means, when suddenly her hands came forward and up, spread like claws or the reach of a smaller child, playing ghosts or monsters. But her fingers kept coming and lit upon my chest, ever so briefly still, then launched into a spidery dance of side to side, of up and down. Beethoven's Ode to Joy thrummed above my lungs as if she were typing out a secret, well-known message. No, I could not decipher that music's motion upside down and silent. She hummed as well, her fully childish voice releasing that long-ago tale of maturity, as if it were the simplest thing of all to offer up the musings of a genius. What she played, I could not play. My hands from earliest days, fat hams, stuck to the platter of my thinking. Music's flags and circles, a Russian I could not read. But I'd had ear enough to follow the lead of her growing fingers. At 7, then 8, then 9, on the keys, which led to hammers and wires and board, which had lifted sound through our every room and wall.
My daughter playing Beethoven on my chest from Stephen Corey's book of poems, There Is No Finished World. And this is New Letters on the Air. White Pine Press, where is that publisher?
Buffalo, New York.
From up in your old stomping grounds.
Yes. That's very cool. Long-lived, very successful press.
Well, we're talking about your work, but specifically your most recent book that's come out, Startled at the Big Sound, Essays Personal, Literary, and Cultural. It's a wonderful book that really spans the decades of your life. And we find out a lot about your thoughts about being a poet, being an editor, being a father, being a son. I mean, we get to see different parts of life in general, but specifically your intellectual life. Tell me about the beginnings of this book. What made you decide to put this together before, let's say, a new and selected book of poetry?
It goes back to somewhere around 1990 or so, at which point I had already published a couple of chapbooks. And I discovered that I'd run up against some things that I couldn't write poems about. And I decided, well, maybe I can do something in a prose form. I mean, obviously, I've been writing prose for my entire life, whether as a first grader or a high school student or a PhD student or an editor. But I hadn't really thought about writing essays. And so I ventured into one, and I found in that instance it worked out for me. So suddenly it was something that I had in mind. I had actually accumulated a list of failed poems, and so several of the pieces that eventually ended up in the book were things that I attacked after I failed with the poems, and they worked out.
I think you actually mentioned that.
I think it comes up at a point in the book, yes. Yeah. And then probably as much as a decade ago, I got the idea that, well, maybe there are enough of these things around. Because, I mean, I would write one year and maybe a couple, 3 years later, I wasn't writing them all the time.
And you would publish them sometimes in other literary journals.
A lot of them were published, yes. And I got to thinking, there's probably enough there that I could put a book together. But like most everything else other than my daily work with the Georgia Review, it kept getting put off. And then I was actually approached by Mark Jolly at Mercer University Press down in Macon, Georgia. He said, if you ever have something, poetry or prose, that you would like us to look at, we'd be glad to have a look. And that was enough of a kick in the head to get me going to working on it. So I put it together and things worked out.
It's a good looking book. They did a great job.
They
with
did.
It. I love the cover.
Which is a photograph taken by my daughter, Rebecca.
Really?
Quite a while ago in Italy. She was not even a semi-professional photographer, but a very accomplished amateur. And I got the idea to show them some of her photos, and she chose some, and they liked it well enough to also put it on the cover of their catalog.
That's really wonderful. Now, you've got four daughters.
Yes.
I know that Startled at the Big Sound comes from one of the essays
right.
about
that daughter, yes.
That same daughter. So tell us about where this title came from.
Well, our two older daughters are much older than our two younger daughters. The two older ones we acquired in what some comedian once referred to as the regular way. And the two younger ones are adopted. And Rebecca, who's daughter number three, was adopted from South Korea. And our youngest daughter, Catherine, was adopted from Peru. And just ahead of the time that Rebecca came to us from South Korea, she came when she was about 5 months old. And we were sent a report on her, how her life had been so far. And it was a report that obviously was originally written in Korean and was then translated into English for us by someone who knew English quite well but was not a native speaker. And it was full of wonderful translated bits. The essay itself ultimately argues that all poetry is a kind of translation. But the phrase that stuck in my mind most, and which I stole half of for the title of the book, said, and remember, this is about a, say, four-month-old child, and the document read, "She is startled at the big sound. She is dazzled at the bright light." And, hey, there it was.
So did this essay then come out of a failed poem? Did you try to take that and use it almost like a found poem?
Yeah, and that was, as I recall, the second of the pieces that I worked on in that realm of failure. The first one was the opening piece in the book about the Vietnam War and my father and conscientious objectorship and all that.
Right, because your father served in the military, and
right.
you were all worried about your number coming up, as everyone
was. I was in the first draft lottery, right.
Yeah. I'm going to get you to read something else from your collection, There Is No Finished World. I like it because it has to do with poetry, but it also has to do with life as an editor. And this one, we're at a death watch.
Okay. You know, you always get admonitions in the course of your life as a writer to be aware of writing poems about poetry. But nobody ever gave me an admonition to not write a poem about editing. I have several, but This is in the form of a rejection letter. And it's called Editing Poems During a Hospital Death Watch. And yes, editors really do read manuscripts everywhere, all the time. Dear poet, I'm sorry, but I couldn't use your art today to soothe or distract me from this death. Not quite accomplished yet, but pressing out as twitchings of her cold and curling feet, as ulcerous brown blood seeping with her breath. I expect, had you known, you might have sent something more attuned to the current path my mother-in-law is facing. I'm sure you're thinking this private critique unfair, and you'd be right to be upset, except that you'd be wrong. This place, right here, is where we always meet. Beatrice, with her chart, devoid of final blessings. You and I, searching for the words that nail sensation to the sky.
That's from Stephen Corey's book, There Is No Finished World, and this is New Letters on the Air. You know, what I love about poetry is that it explores all parts of the world, but so often poets can bring in their private lives with their families to highlight important things that are going on, not just in their lives, but in life in general. And I think you cover the gamut here. This is divided up into several parts, you know, understand poems of this size, measures, mortal fathers and daughters, stone at stone. It's a good read.
I'm going to make a little trouble by saying, of course, that poem I just read could have all been made up.
Of course it can.
All right.
You cannot assume that the I in poems is the poet. It can be a persona telling the story. But there was something so much about that being the editor that I just did assume that was you.
Well, and I'm not saying that you're wrong, but I will say that I do have poems that I believe sound just as much as though they must be out of a real experience that are not. And I think that's one of the things that it's important to be able to do. Because, I mean, one of the unfortunate limitations that a lot of writers, maybe poets in particular, put on themselves is that they too often look to themselves for the subject, for the narrative.
And they don't use fiction or pulling from the world.
As if they, you know, and all poets do that, and probably almost all of the great poets have done that. But I think you need to do the other as well. I mean, you need to at least see something totally other than yourself through yourself, you know, react to it.
Right. Years back, you helped compile and edit a book called Spreading the Word, Editors on Poetry. This was a great book. This came out in 2001, sort of a second rendition that had been started, I believe, by Warren Schlesinger. And it includes an essay by you as the editor of the Georgia Review, but also editors across the country. And I love the way you guys have it organized by the oldest magazine up to the newest one. It's chronologically ordered, which I thought was a neat way to do it. Was the first one done that way, too?
The first edition was Warren Schlesinger's idea, and I was among the people who were invited to submit a piece to it. I think it was 1990 when he brought that out from his little, essentially, one-man press, the Bench Press in Beaufort, South Carolina.
It's interesting because Spreading the Word also has an essay by my boss at New Letters Magazine, Robert Stewart.
Right. And then roughly a decade later, I think he'd finally sold them all, and he decided that he wanted to do a new edition. And so he asked me if I would like to work with him on putting out a second edition, and so I did. We eliminated a few of the essays from the original book. We added more than we took out so that the second one is bigger. It's worth mentioning for the historical record, I wasn't taking advantage of being an editor and getting my piece into a book. It was originally chosen by somebody else. He insisted that we keep it.
Yes.
In the second one.
And it's really good. And makes a reappearance in your new book, Startled at the Big Sound.
Yeah, that helps tell you how far back the pieces in that book go. It cover about 25 years.
I really liked your essay. I had actually marked the last paragraph of this essay. Would you like to read that?
I'll be glad to. It was an assignment, and you're asked to take a poem, talk about it in a way that somehow characterized your way of dealing with manuscripts, poems in particular, as an editor. And I'm just going to mention the poem. I still think it's a truly great poem by a man named David Swanger, and it's called What the Wing Says. So I urge everybody to go find it. And I discuss the poem in some loving detail in the course of the essay. It's a short piece, 5 pages, I think. I conclude with this, and I should say the obvious, I guess, that I'm always a poet and an editor. I mean, when I'm editing, I'm a writer. When I'm writing, I'm an editor. And for me, at least, they have evolved inextricably with one another. Poem after poem limps across my desk, held up by the twin crutches of sensitive intelligence and passionate good intention. I say this not with malice, but with sadness and hard-headed respect. Poems are seldom written by stupid or mean-spirited people, and this fact needs to be remembered by everyone, especially editors. Nonetheless, the writing of outstanding poems requires much more, demands those rare combinations and instances of imaginative rendering. One might also say creative genius, that are so impossible to describe or predict. Like a swarm of squirming puppies or snakes, one is trying to keep inside an open-topped box. The best poem constantly gets away from us. It has more eyes and legs and tails than we do, to say nothing of quicker reflexes and better instincts. But we love it for its escaping as well as for its feel in our hands. So we give it all we've got, again and again.
That's the end of the essay by Stephen Corey that first appeared in Spreading the Word, Editors on Poetry. And the essay also appears in his 2017 book, Startled at the Big Sound, Essays Personal, Literary, and Cultural. This is New Letters on the Air. You mentioned in here, I compressed my opinions into 5 points, applicable in differing balances to all genres. Physically pleasing flow of language, you're talking about how you choose poetry, fresh metaphor, connection with the ongoing human world, wholeness of the particular imaginative realm created, and surprise, including, though not necessarily, the absence of one or all of the first 4 elements, which is there are no hard and fast rules.
That list that you summarized, it's an example of one of, if not the greatest moment of thoughtful, creative fortune in my life, because it originated in an assignment that I was given during the application process for a job as assistant editor at the Georgia Review. And I hadn't formulated it in those terms before I was given this assignment. And I still cling to it very strongly, not just because it got me a job, because I think I got something in the course of the time that I worked on that, something I figured out and something that I could hold on to.
Stan Lindbergh was the editor of the Georgia Review at the time that you came on, right?
Right.
You guys were good friends. I mean, he was your boss, but you were also...
Yeah, well, we became good friends. Yeah, I worked for him for 17 years before he passed away too young in 2000.
Yeah. There was a passage in here that I marked, and it has to do with some of the difficulties that you have encountered as a poet. It's from the essay, Remembering to Be Perplexed, on a string around your finger and no beauty. Do you want to read that and then read the poem?
I can certainly do that. There was an invitation from this magazine. Well, it wasn't an invitation, it was a demand that after they accepted, I didn't know this, I don't think, but after they accepted a poem from you, or in this case, I had two poems accepted, they then asked you to write something somehow about those poems to go along with the poems. The essay followed the poems in the composition. A number of years ago, I went through a phase, I want to say, in my writing, but I fear it was in my general life as well, when I let myself believe that I had learned some things, that I had picked up a little of what is most commonly called wisdom. I was not conscious at the time of having slid into this mentality, but rather became aware of it as I began to drift past or back off from it. My poems mostly suffered from this attitude I had taken on. Instead of being conceived through a descriptive image, a musical run of words, or an emotion needing some kind of articulation, my new pieces tended to be set going by broad statements or assertions which had popped into my mind and had seemed at the time smart and even memorable. The playing out of such a poem then called for the finding of ways to illustrate and reassert its initial premise rather than the more intense and diffuse act of finding. I would never try to argue that any given approach to creating poems is doomed to failure. Just look at the history of outstanding American poetry, especially in the past 150 years. But I sense that my own best work usually emerges from a flash in the eye or a catch in the gut, rather than from a light bulb in the brain. Wallace Stevens' greatness lay, in vital part, in his knowing how to work all three of these, back and forth and entwining. We can only hope we are not too old to learn new tricks. When I realized over time that my dominant approach to initiating poems had shifted, often to the detriment of the work involved, I tried to reach, as in revert, consciously. Of course, this gesture was itself generated from the more rational side of my thinking, which means that it was part of the problem, and therefore not capable of fully resolving my newfound concern. But because my earlier ways of working through image and so on remained my most honest and effective, I think that forcing myself to turn back to them helped me to lean toward and then slide back into using them again quite naturally and consistently. One way to solve a problem is to deny it by bullying on through, acting as though the problem either isn't there or could be neutralized if approached from just the right angle. I think this is what I am doing in No Beauty, where I try to work from an idea that is really a sort of anti-idea, focused on what the poem should not do rather than what it should. Such development as the poem has is then achieved via a series of harsh and even repulsive images. Thought is bludgeoned by sensation, confidence by confusion, wisdom by the uncertainties of daily, moment-to-moment existence. And a famous wise line by a great poet is stolen and put in to use in a context so different from its original that, I hope, readers might be baffled yet intrigued. My dictionary gives the following primary definition for perplex: to make a person uncertain, doubtful, or hesitant, confuse, puzzle. The etymology of the term traces back to the Latin perplexus, itself made up of per, through, and plexus, to twist or plait. I don't subscribe to the theory that serious original art must be difficult for an audience to interpret and understand, but I do believe that the making of art, the conceiving, executing, and reworking, must be a complicated, open-ended challenge. I see the verbal form of plexus above, and I am led to the noun form, a complexly interconnected arrangement of parts, network. Yes, I think that's it. To begin the argument, the painting, or the poem, knowing consciously or unconsciously that the answers and the ending are self-defeating and, more important, art-defeating. This does not mean that no answers can ever be come to, though I do believe they are always in short supply. Never simple, and quite likely to spawn other questions. And so I have been working extra hard of late to shun the false idol of wisdom and to embrace the bugaboo of perplexity. Here's the poem that was referenced. No beauty. This once, it must not turn beautiful. No, I don't mean another bucket dampened with crocodile tears, musty and ripe for scattering to the impoverished tens of thousands, rocking and keening in the dust, to the millions starving far from the smell of ink. I mean no beauty close to home, where every zero counts and burns each day. My oldest daughter, fear in her eyes, when a man she's never met reaches out along the crowded bar to grab her wrist and hold, to drill his stares at her face while he wishes them hands at her crotch. My adopted youngest, fresh from the triumph that walking becomes for parent and child alike, dreaming with no conception of dreams the life she might have stayed with in the arms of her child mother, wandering meek and filthy the desert streets of Lima, Peru. My wife, at work with her cooling dead, occasionally two or three per shift. How the time must come for the silenced or wailing families to step outside the room, to slough themselves away, that she may plug and wrap and bag what had had a memory, a certain tone of voice. Here is where we feel and know, there where we think and pretend. Music and wit are not exempt from limit. A terrible beauty is merely terrible.
Stephen Corey, reading his poem, No Beauty. That one does have some autobiographical details, featuring his now-grown daughters and his wife, a hospice nurse. Before that, we heard an excerpt from Remembering to Be Perplexed, the essay that accompanies this poem in his book, Startled at the Big Sound, Essays Personal, Literary, and Cultural, published by Mercer University Press. The Georgia Review editor, Stephen Corey, was recorded at WUGA in August 2017. He recently announced his upcoming retirement from the Lauded magazine later in 2019 and has promised his best issues yet ahead of this transition. I'm looking forward to his collected poetry that he'll work on in retirement. For links, visit newletters.org, a production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC. Today's show was produced with Danny Reeves, Cedric Hurt, Claire Verbeck, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.